Golf Smarter Premium number 506, published on September 15, 2015.
This episode of Golf Smarter is brought to you by Harry's, for guys like you who want a great shave experience for a fraction of what you're paying now. Go to harrys.com and get $5 off your first purchase by entering the code GOLFSMARTER when you check out.
Golf courses don't need to be harder to be better, with designer of Bandon Dunes, David McClay Kidd.
This is Golf Smarter Premium. Here's your host, Fred Green.
Welcome to the Golf Smarter Podcast, David.
Thanks very much, Fred. It's great to be here.
It is great to have you here. We had a interesting introduction to one another out at TPC Stonebrae, which is one of your courses.
It is, yep. It was opened back in 2008, I believe, and the timing was a little challenging for the real estate market. They were maybe a year too late, but they seem to be doing great now. The project's really thriving. The clubhouse is open and the real estate's selling, and I hadn't played it in a couple of years, and I went back and I think self-doubt is one of the things all designers suffer from. So having not played it in a couple of years, I went back and was thrilled. You know, the course is great fun to play and is in great condition, and everyone seemed to have a good time, and I loved it. It was great to be back after having missed it for a couple of years.
I had played it when it first opened as well in a press event, and it is definitely a more mature course than. Was it a public course when it first opened?
I don't believe so. It was and is part of the TPC network. So if you're a TPC member, I think there's something like 27 or so golf courses in that network. Mm-hmm. You can play it, but I'm not sure you can play it if you're a member of the public and you just call up and book a tee time. I think you have to either get a referral through your own club or be part of the TPC network.
Yeah, I think you do. But it's a fascinating course. It's not your normal golf course that runs back and forth and back and forth. You've got a lot of work to do to get through that golf course.
You do. I mean, the average golf course probably covers, 150 acres maybe. That golf course covers three times that. I mean, it really rolls across those Hayward Hills in all sorts of unusual and unpredictable directions. Thankfully, the owner, a Hong Kong Chinese family, had many thousands of acres from which to choose from, and they allowed me to wander across those Hayward Hills pretty much in any direction I wanted. The real challenge was getting all the permits together and then building it.
Why was that the challenge? Because just politics in the area?
Probably politics. You know, there was a red-legged frog and the Alameda whip snake are both inhabitants of that area. So we probably, rightly so, had to jump through a lot of hoops to make sure that we protected both those species. And, of course, the wetlands and waterways of the great state of California. So the developer spent many extra millions making sure that all of those things were protected. And I think that shows in the results. The golf course blends in very naturally into its surroundings.
Wow, those are two words that I've not heard associated with California in a long time. Wetlands and waterways.
Yeah, well, even back then in 2006 and 7 when we were building it, I would scratch my head and say, this is a wetland. We're 1,000 feet above the bay on a slope I could probably ski on in Oregon, and this is a waterway, a wetland. But the definition is definitely conservative, put it that way.
Yeah, to say the least. So when you're approached by, you said you were approached by the owners. Did they know at that point it's a TPC course? How did TPC get involved?
The owners hired a developer called Mike Lettinger. And Mike Lettinger is a guy from Washington, D.C., and he had spent the early part of his career developing the TPC courses with Dean Beeman and the PGA Tour. And so Mike had an existing strong relationship with the TPC network. And so once the course opened, or before it opened, Mike brought in the tour and asked them if this course was of a caliber that they would consider adding it to their network. And they quickly did. It was part of the network long before opening.
Very interesting.
So that was, for me, that was a really cool thing. You know, there aren't, as I say, there's less than 30, I believe, TPC courses in the United States. So, and of those, there aren't 30 architects. There are, you know, many of them have done more than one. So there may be 20 odd golf course designers who have that on their resume, and I get to be one of them.
Well, there's a couple things on your resume that make you stand out going, oh, he's the guy that did that. This
is
not the only.
To say.
Yeah, this is not the only golf course that you have that on your resume, and we'll get to that in a minute. But I want to start. Well, we've already started, so I want to continue this point by talking about how you became a golf course architect. That was it in your blood? Was it in your head? How did this start?
Well, I was literally conceived and born on a golf course, or very close to one. My father is a golf course superintendent, or a head greenkeeper, as it would be called back in the old country where I'm from. And so my father worked on a golf course from 14 years old and married his childhood sweetheart. And he became the youngest head greenkeeper in a generation, at least, if not longer. He was the head greenkeeper at Glasgow Golf Club in his early 20s. Which is the ninth oldest golf course on earth. And he lived with his family on the side of one of the golf holes in a house owned by the golf club from the 1700s. And I was born and raised there.
Are you okay?
Yeah, I just tripped over the phone.
it's like you got silent. I was like, are you okay?
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Yeah. Tripped over the phone. Okay.
So did you tag along with your dad the whole time? I mean, did you like know from the beginning? It's like, I want to just be here with my daddy.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. I wanted to, from an early age, my dad's getting up at 4 a.m. to go out on the golf course and working all the daylight hours in the summertime and wintertime, although they're a lot less. And very often he's taken me with him. So from...
And that was appealing to you? Getting up at that time? Really?
Well, hanging out with my dad was appealing.
Not as a teenager, I can't believe.
I don't think I was up at that time in the morning. But from a very young age, I was out raking bunkers and fly mowing banks and edging bunkers and mowing greens as I was older. And even as a teenager, you know, that work ethic was burnt into me. I mean, I don't think I got the luxury of laying in bed till noon. I was told from maybe about 12 years old, if I wanted to buy something, then I had to earn the money to go buy it. And earning the money meant helping my dad on the golf course. So I was out there doing it. And did I love it? I'm not sure I sort of said, oh my goodness, I'm desperate to get up before the dawn and go rake bunkers. I just saw it as this was what we did. This is what my father earned his living at. And I saw it as a rewarding thing that he enjoyed and I could enjoy with him. And I loved spending time with him then and now. As I grew older, I realized that the maintenance of golf courses was only one part of it. There were other parts to the process that created a golf course, design and construction being the other two main ones. So when I explored those two at my father's behest, I discovered that I absolutely loved the creative part of it, even more than I loved the maintenance part of it. And so that's what took me down that path.
Do you remember times as a kid at night, at home, the family after dinner, all together, sitting around, whether you were sitting by the fire and reading, you were watching TV, whatever the family activity at night was, did you pick your dad's brain about groundskeeping or did you talk about golf design?
Both.
Well, you did?
You know, my mother has never played golf and my sister barely played, and she's 3.5 years younger. So as a kid, quite a bit younger. Where I heard it all was the frequent family journeys to other golf courses, because my dad's closest friends were other greenkeepers.
Oh, okay.
It was George Brown at Turnberry or Walter Woods at St. Andrews or Chris Kennedy at Hags Castle. It was these guys are legends in that world. And, you know, my dad is one of them. So as a kid, I would spend the weekend staying at somebody else's house and I'd be listening to these adults debate their profession that they are incredibly passionate about. And they would argue till the early hours with a bottle of whiskey about POA control or how to make the greens faster or truer, or whether the stimp meter was a useful application in their profession, or whether a committee should be structured this way or that way, or a million different things, none of which I at the time understood what I was learning until I was in the profession myself. And I could recall back to these conversations that had gone on and recall back to the arguments for and against any particular course of action. And it wasn't until 10, 15, 20 years later that I thought, wow, that was quite the education I was getting.
Oh, well, it's nice that you did appreciate it eventually.
Eventually, yeah. But I, even at the time, I just loved hanging out with these guys and absorbing their passion for golf and golf courses. And of course, to them, the, as with many golfers, the history and traditions of the game were paramount. So each of these people, these men, appreciated that old Tom Morris had designed the course 100 years before, or James Braid and the great triumvirate had designed Gleneagles 70 years before, which is where my father had been. So I heard all about the course of time and golf and architecture and tradition and the different styles of architecture. And so all of this was being bled into me slowly over the course of a childhood.
And were you playing golf at all too, or are you just cleaning up?
You know, I wasn't playing that much golf. Here's a strange rule. Many golf courses in Scotland do not allow the greenkeeper even to play the golf course, certainly back then. And they certainly don't allow the family of the greenkeeper to be out there playing on a member, on a private member's golf course. So early in my childhood, no, I did not get to play the very golf course that my father was in charge of. He did. But there are plenty of other superintendents, even today, that are not allowed to play the course without special permission, which is a hang up to the class system of the United Kingdom. One of the reasons I prefer it here in the United States. So I guess it wasn't until my early teenage years that my father left a private club and he moved to a commercial project, the Gleneagles Resort in the middle of Scotland. And there was little class hang up. So there he was in charge of all the golf courses, and with his permission, I could play wherever and whenever I wanted. So from about 13 or 14 years old, I could play a lot more, and myself and my best friend would play, you know, 36 holes after school in the summertime, which for those of you that have been to Scotland in midsummer know that that's possible. It doesn't get dark till 11 o'clock at night, and you can play golf in 2.5 hours.
2.5 hours?
Easily.
Really?
Really.
What's the difference?
Well, you're not dilly-dallying. You're not in a cart. You're not hitting it in the weeds. You know, you're playing golf and you're playing quickly. I mean, it amazes me when people, even a 4-hour round. When I got a little older, I thought 4 hours to play golf, that's forever. And the thought of playing in 5 hours just kills you.
Yeah.
You know, 4 hours is what it takes to play the old course on the busiest day. So if you're going out at 4 or 5 o'clock in the evening on the Prince's course at Gleneagles, which no longer exists, which from the tees we played was, you know, 5,800 yards, we could easily play that in 2.5 hours.
Wow. Wait, are you inferring that rounds take longer here because people are spending time looking for their balls?
And they can do. Or they just have this pre-shot routine that takes 5 minutes on every shot.
And so, they don't do that in Scotland?
Not so much. Not so much.
Now you're being
it's
an elitist.
It's a little frustrating.
Now you're being the elitist that you're dead.
Well, I'm definitely a golfing elitist. We have a charity event here in Bend, Oregon, where I live, where they do a golf marathon. You have to play 100 holes in a single day. You'd be amazed how many people, almost everyone says the same thing. Because they're playing 100 golf holes, which is, what, 5.5 rounds of golf in a single day. There's no pre-shot routine. There's no worrying about exactly where to hit it. There's just run up to the ball, take a stance, hit the ball. everybody says, you know, I played much better than I expected.
Interesting.
That's because you weren't thinking about it and you just hit it.
Mm-hmm.
And after two or three rounds like that in a single day, the last couple of rounds could be the best golf you've ever played because you stop worrying, just hit it. Your body already knows what to do. Just get your mind out of the way.
I had a friend who did one of those charity events, and he was in the high 80s as far as how many holes that he had played that day. And there were people that were finished. And he was like, how did you finish that much far ahead of me? And he says, because I played multiple balls on the par threes. It's like, you're kidding. You can do that?
So they played three balls and said, well, that's three holes out of the way.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm not sure that counts.
They told him it did. He was frustrated. He was like, no, I'm going to play one ball every hole. I'll be here until I can't play anymore.
Yeah,
And he couldn't walk
one
ball.
You can take a bucket of balls with you, and if you hit one in the crap, just re-tee it and hit it again. I'll give you that. But you can't play three balls out and say, well, I just played three holes. I don't think that counts. That's against it.
Oh, well. Is is your dad still around?
Oh, yeah.
Good.
He's, not only is he still around, he's still very much involved in my business.
Oh, he is?
Only today he spent the day at a course we're finishing up in London. And was working with the superintendent and the owner and helping them with the growing. They had their first little preview event at the weekend. My father was over there at 5 in the morning with the superintendents, helping them set the course up and set pin placements and do all of that stuff. So he absolutely loves it as much today as he did 20 or 40 years ago.
Well, of course he does, because he's doing it for and with his son.
Yeah, I'll say with, not for. He wouldn't appreciate that. Okay. Definitely with.
Sorry, Pop. but he's got to be very proud of you.
I think he gets a kick out of the fact that, you know, he started working on a golf course in the early 60s and, you know, wasn't allowed in to play the courses that he was maintaining and, you know, was a you know, how can I put it? If you can imagine the class system at a snooty club in the United Kingdom, and now I get invited to go play those places, and you know the whole thing has flipped on its head in a single generation. I certainly love the fact that he gets to see that.
Well, it sounds like he hasn't told you he's proud. We're proud of you, David.
Well,
you're doing
I appreciate
a great
that.
Job.
Well, I keep trying.
Now, let's talk about your design philosophy. You told a wonderful story at the dinner at TPC Stonebray that I want to try to get you to repeat about what you see.
Oh, you have to give me more of a hint than that. I can't remember what I said.
What do you see when you're looking out there? Right? You were telling a story about the mission.
I can't exactly remember the story. But
you mean you made
general,
it up that night?
Yeah, I don't think I made it up, but I definitely was on a roll.
You really were.
You know, I see a golf course as an opportunity for grown men to go explore the way they did when they were children. And that seems to be something that is lost in the modern world we live in. You know, the middle-aged man is responsible. And I keep saying man, but it could be women, but we know what a male-dominated sport this is. You know, they're working hard, they're, you know, providing for their family, they're worrying about today, they're worrying about tomorrow and the market and their pension and their this and that and a million other things, and they don't get to be children anymore. And golf is one of the pursuits where they can kind of regress for a few hours and be more childlike. And part of that experience allows me to allow them to explore again, to go across a piece of land and crest a hill or round a pond or disappear behind a tree and see what's there and be at one with nature and to explore. And if golf loses that, then it loses its core. It loses something absolutely essential to the sport. It's not just about standing on a tee and aiming at a flag away in the distance. It's more than that. And that exploration of the landscape is key to it. You know, 18 wonderful individual golf holes that play up and down like soldiers is not a golf experience. You want it to be something like Abandoned Dunes or a Stonebray, where the golf course meanders and is, in some respects, you can see it in front of you. And then in another turn, you don't know where you're going. You're lost. You're having to scratch your head and decipher some clues ahead of you to try and figure out what's coming next. And that's all part of the wonderful experience of golf that exists in no other sport. There's nothing else in the world of sport like it, and we can't lose it.
So true. It's an interesting perspective on that. Do you have a design strategy that you carry with you from project to project, or is it unique to each project?
I'll give you that in two answers, I guess. I don't have a design style, which sometimes people mistake the word strategy and style. I wouldn't like to think that I have an absolute definitive style where I'm going to go to each project and I'm going to build bunkers that look like X. And no matter where I am, they're going to look like X. That's what I'm going to do. And there are plenty of architects who do that, and they make a good career out of it. They build one style of golf course and they replicate that style wherever they find themselves. I choose not to do that for numerous reasons, the greatest of which is the fact that I want the land to dictate the style. The particular circumstance of that project needs to dictate the style rather than just me as a brand name saying, well, my style is this and this is what I create. So there's one answer to that question. On the second part, is there a strategic style, if you like, or what was your question? A strategy that I take
design
from course
strategy.
To course?
Yeah.
Yes, I think there probably is. As a strategist on the golf course, I try not to defend against a player who is attempting to make, let's say, bogey. Yeah, I try not to punish a player who already made a tactical error in his strategic attack on a golf hole. So I rarely will position bunkers in a spot that punish a bad shot, because the bad shot virtually every single time is punishment in itself. Mm. If you top the ball 100 yards off the tee, I don't really need to put you in a bunker because you topped the ball 100 yards off the tee.
Right.
So if you're playing one of my golf courses and you see a hazard ahead of you, whether it's a topographical hazard, a bunker, a different height of cut, an area that's visually guarded, you know, there's a mound in the way that's blocking your view a little bit, chances are that my defense of that particular spot is because that particular spot is the A position to make birdie. So you have to get close to that spot in order to make birdie. I once had a tour pro tell me, I played one of your golf courses and I didn't like it. I was like, well, why didn't you like it? He said, well, I was playing great and I was in bunkers all day long. And I was playing with a guy who was playing terrible and he never was in a single bunker. How is that a good golf course? Well, he answered his own question. He wasn't playing great. He was playing almost great. Mm. If he'd been playing great, he'd been right next to all those bunkers. And his buddy who was playing terrible, exactly, he was playing terrible. Why do I need to put him in a bunker? Mm-hmm. So that would be my strategic style, I guess, would be the defense of the aggressive line.
Mm-hmm. I think Robert Trent Jones Sr. called it a difficult par. Easy bogey, difficult par.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and I've... You know, every golf course designer has the same rhetoric. They all talk about, you know, defending par and how natural their golf course design is. You know, there isn't a golf course architect in the modern era, at least, who doesn't say both those things. Mm. And yet I go play many golf courses by my peers and think, well, I heard them say it, but I sure as hell don't see it.
Now, let's talk about, let's say, a par three. Do you try to create some sort of, what's the word, deception or a distraction?
You know what? My theory on this has changed dramatically over the last 10 years.
Well, I got a scoop here.
I don't know how much of a scoop it is. It's certainly something that I've been promoting as much as I can over the last 10 years. Golf course architects have been living a lie You know, I think that's basically it. You know, we take our inspiration from the very best, pseudo best golf courses that have ever existed. The Pine Valleys, the Cypress Points, the Oakmonts, the Merions, and we hold them up as the perfect golf courses. And yet they're not. They're not even close to the perfect golf courses for the average player. For the average player, they couldn't get around those golf courses day in, day out in under 100, mm-hmm. maybe 90. Is that really what we want to go building as golf course architects? Why is it that Bandon Dunes is so successful? Why do people flock to it year after year after year? Because they're playable, because they're fun, because they don't feel intimidated, because they don't feel humiliated. That is such a key important point that took me so long to re-understand. I absolutely intuitively knew it in my 20s, coming from Scotland, unaffected by the golf that exists in America. And then for the next 10 or 15 years, I was seduced by the thought that golf, to be better, has to be harder. And it absolutely does not need to be harder to be better.
You just came up with the title of this show. It doesn't have to be harder to be better.
It doesn't. It absolutely does not. And so, if you take that logic and you really start to think it through, you really start to examine it, what are the reasons that people play bad? Well, we said earlier in this conversation that your body already knows what to do. It's your mind that screws it up. Mm-hmm. So why does your mind screw it up? Well, consciously, it's because you're thinking about all these tips that you read in every damn magazine with 1,000 different tips. And every time you turn the golf channel on, there's some guy telling you to hold it this way, tweak it that way, push your hips out, do this, do that. So your mind consciously goes there. But where does it subconsciously go? It subconsciously goes to all the things that are going to go wrong, all the reasons why you are going to fail, even before you take that club back. Every one of us plays our home golf course and we go out and we get to a hole and we pull the tee out of our pocket and we put it in the ground and we already know as we bend down to put that ball on the tee peg, I'm going to lose this ball. Why are you going to lose it? Because you lose it every time you play this hole. Why are you not going to make par or even bogey? Because you never make, you know, this is your double hole. You always make double here. But why? You look at it, it's not that hard. It's because it's all in your head. You're so intimidated by that particular hole, you just can't get past it. Flip that on its head, there's another hole. You pull the tee out, you stick it in the ground, you say, this is my birdie hole. I make birdie here all the time. This is a great hole. I love this hole. Mm-hmm. Is it because it's easier? I don't think it's easier. I mean, any hole, if it's, you know, 350 to 450 yards long with a cup at one end, it's not easier. For the average guy, it still requires 2 reasonably good shots and a couple of putts to make par. So what was the real difference? It was what your mind told you. It was the sense of peace, the sense of hope that you have in your head when you step up to that ball. So as a golf course designer, can I go out and build 18 holes that give you a sense of hope, that give you encouragement, that don't intimidate you? That you could feel, I got a chance here. Now, if I could do that 18 times, would that course be loved or derided? Would people think this course was too easy or a blast? I would make the position that Bandon Dunes is the former, not the latter. You stand on every hole at Bandon and you think to yourself, I got a chance here. And even when you hit a bad one, I got a chance to get back here. Because it's full of hope and recovery. There's no intimidation, very, very little. And so that becomes much more appealing than a golf course that has 18 holes of like climbing Everest. One tiny mistake, I'm going to die. Mm. And for me, that's where I want my career to go forward. I want to build golf courses. Sure, you got to play well to make birdies, but you don't have to play that well to make bogeys. In fact, I'm going to do everything in my power, everything, as a golf course designer, to help you make bogey. I'm going to make sure you don't lose that ball. I'm going to make sure that green doesn't throw you away. I'm going to make sure that that bunker does have some opportunity for recovery because you're already in it. Because once you're in trouble, I don't have to make it harder. In fact, I'm going to do the opposite of that and try and make it a little easier on you so that you can get back in the game.
Thank you. We appreciate that. I wish it were so true. I mean, you've mentioned now Bandon Dunes a couple times, and we teased it early on that you are the... Now, did you design all the courses at Bandon Dunes?
Oh, I wish I could say yes. I wish I could say yes. Mm. But unfortunately, no. I did the first one. And I love the fact that I did the first one.
Which course?
Bandon Dunes.
Okay, yeah.
Without the first one, the others obviously wouldn't have had a chance to exist.
Sure.
And it set the course by which all the others followed. And as I said, the Bandon Dunes covers a great amount of land. You know, the fairways are vast. Mm-hmm. The greens are huge. But fundamentally, the golf course is still the same length as any other golf course, and the cup is still 4 1/4 inches. So for the average guy to get it from tee to cup is just as hard. They still have to hit it a couple of times and putt. So so much of this game is about, in the average golfer's eyes, what happens when I screw up, because I know I'm going to. And if, as a golf course designer, I can not punish screw-ups, I can actually aid screw-ups, then the golf course becomes so much more fun. And to self-promote just a tiny bit, if I can, the last two or three courses that me and my small team have done, we've taken this theory that we've discussed ad nauseum, mm-hmm. and we've put it into practice to see what the reaction is. And the latest incarnation of that is a course up in central Washington called Gamble Sands. And we built that course with the logic that I've been mentioning. People absolutely love it. The last time I had reactions like this was 20 years ago building Bandon Dunes.
Mm.
The average player absolutely loves it, but so do the pros. They go around it. They think they can shoot 59, 62, 64. They think that they can absolutely kill it. But of course, the more aggressive they get, and as I said earlier, the hazards are next to those aggressive lines, the more quickly that they can end up punished. The tighter the margin of error becomes between a perfect shot and a recovery shot. But for the average golfer who's just trying to keep it in play and make pars, they're not aiming at those super tight lines. So that they get to shoot good scores. And then everything else is about keeping them in play. So in every tee, they have that sense of, oh, this is a green light hole. This isn't a danger hole. I'm not going to lose this ball. I can go after this. I can be aggressive. And because they can, they do. And because they do, they succeed. So because the danger isn't quite so terminal, they have a more fluid, more comfortable swing, and they hit the ball straighter, longer, better, higher. You know, everything gets better.
I personally, Bandon beat me up. I was out there on a beautiful but incredibly windy weekend, and the four courses that we played, including Bandon, just devastated me. I came home. It wasn't until I started looking at all my photographs that I realized how much fun I had. But when I left there, I was crying. I mean, it felt brutal.
I can take no blame nor credit for the weather.
No, nor my golf.
And even if the wind isn't blowing, you know, it's a completely different game. I mean, how close is the golf that most people are playing in America, where they're hitting it off Bermuda grass or bluegrass to a bent grass green that's running at 12, to then flipping that on its head and going to Bandon Dunes, where you're hitting it off a fairway that's tighter than your parking lot and a green that's pitching and rolling and as slow as the tees at many clubs. You know, this is links golf. It's a completely different game. Mm-hmm. So for a lot of people, it's a re-education. They have to learn that little chip shot. They understand or they come to understand that they've been playing golf their whole entire lives, hitting it slightly fat. And if you hit the ball a little bit fat at Bandon Dunes, you're going to get sore wrists and the ball's not going to do what you think it's going to do. Mm-hmm. You have to be able to hit the ball first. You have to be able to try and hit right behind that ball and press it down into the turf. And so that takes, even for the best of golfers, that can be a learning process where they have to understand that it's not about this giant divot that they take that's a fraction of an inch behind the ball and they still get a good result. It's not how it works on links golf. Got to hit the ball first.
Because, I do audio and video production, and I like doing that because I can continue to manipulate my project until I feel it's ready. And then when I feel like it's ready, before I present it to my client, my customer, I sit on it for a few minutes a day just in case I, see it with different eyes the next day going, you know what, I want to tweak that. I want to change that a little bit. At what point do you, are you comfortable with handing over the project to your client saying it's done?
I mean, never is the real answer.
Wow.
I mean,
we're
constantly tweaking and adjusting. You know, I explain to every client that, you know, if these golf courses are loved and successful, they're going to be tweaked and adjusted, hopefully by the original architect through at least his lifespan. That's an inevitability with that. When we're building it, once we start to put drainage and irrigation in, my ability to flip-flop and change my mind gets greatly reduced. So that's usually it. But I could shape a hole once and say to the guys, okay, let's put the undergrounds in, or I could shape it 10 times in 3 days. I mean, when you're pushing dirt around, making bunkers, taking them out, putting them back in, shaping a green one way, shaping it another, moving it over to the left, pitching it another direction, we can do that in a few hours. So the time it takes to adjust and readjust prior to the undergrounds going in is very small on the average project. So I do get the chance to futz around quite a bit. And quite often we will conceptualize a hole on paper, get out in the field, totally change our minds, shape something in from tee to green, walk it half a dozen times, really like it, go to lunch, sit and have lunch. Maybe the guys have a beer. Change our minds, come back, blow it up again, change it. You know, it can be that kind of process. It really can be dramatic to end up with something else. And it's all about that process. I'm not saying the first idea wasn't great, but I'm hoping the last idea is 10 times better. And so that process, that morphing from A through Z is an essential part of the creative steps that you're taking. It's much more like sculpture than it is like conventional architecture.
Do you design from the front tees or do you design from the back tees? And I know obviously the tees aren't there, but in your mind, when you're looking down a fairway, do you feel like this is for the better hitters or this is for the people we're going to give them a little break?
Oh, you're going to like this answer.
Okay.
You are 180 degrees wrong. Really? We never ever design it from the tees. We always design it from the green.
Oh.
You always start at the green. Then you work your way back. You're always conceptualizing where this is a good green site. I like this location for whatever reason. How would a green best sit into this piece of ground? Is it going to sit in as a kidney bean left to right? Is it going to sit in falling front to back? Is it going to pitch from left to right or right to left? Where would the bunkers naturally want to sit? So you're designing the green in its environs in a way that is sympathetic to the surrounds that it has to blend back into. And once you have that concept in your head of how that green wants to sit into its environment, you can then step back down the fairway until you're all the way to the back tee, conceptualizing how the player will be asked to attack that green location and shape.
Oh boy, that's completely turned around.
Yeah,
that I was thinking. That's
that
great.
Messed with your head, didn't it?
Yeah. So as a from a golfer's perspective, when we're standing at the tee box, should we be thinking with an architect's mind?
Absolutely, you should. You should be thinking, what does the green look like? And then where is the pin on that green? And then decide your logic coming backwards from there. Where would I like that approach shot to come from? And then back to the tee. Now where do I have to hit it to get that approach shot? You know, there's so many. My other half is a lady tour player, and there are so many simple things that tour players do that the average player does not. You know, if she can't reach a par 5 and 2, she immediately starts to question whether it's worth hitting driver.
Sure.
And then if you're not going to be hitting driver, what are the hazards in your way on that tee shot? Where, you know, 99% of the average golfers, if it's a par four, driver, out it comes. And they rarely think about anything else. So I love to mess with golfers that way. I like to try and convince a golfer that I'm never going to meet that they should hit other clubs, par fours where a six iron might be the best, par threes where a driver might be best, even though it's only 200 yards. All sorts of different things to try and convince someone to think about the trajectory and the potential risk and reward off the tee.
All right, listen, this has been just such an education for me. I really appreciate your time. This is a blast. We're going to take a little break here so I can make an announcement or two and talk about this week's sponsor. And when we come back, can I get you to give us another piece of advice? That last one was incredible. Can we get another piece of advice on how the average golfer should be approaching his game with architect's eyes?
Sure, of course.
Thank you. All right, last week I announced that I injured myself. I tore my right calf muscle and won't be playing golf for a number of weeks. And I appreciate your kind messages. Thank you so much. And some of the great suggestions of how we should approach this. But I think I'm going to continue trying to do the podcast over the next few weeks during my recovery. I just don't have it in my heart to play reruns. Not yet, at least. But they're a premium. They're there. They're for the premium subscribers. And if you have access to it, why should I play it again? So I'm going to try to create new content. Anyway, our guest last week, Jim Venetis, he's captured my attention like few instructors we've had on the show. And based on what you've fed back to me, you liked his teaching style as well. So it just so happens that the day I injured myself, I had been to the range and took video of my swings and sent it to Jim for his analysis and feedback. Well, the comments that he sent back after I injured myself got me just too excited about developing the new swing based on his style of the weight shift and stillness. But I can't do anything about it for a while. So I wrote back to Jim and I told him about my frustration and my predicament. And he suggested that I treat this like it's a winter off. It's the off season. I don't have that being here in California. We get to play 12 months a year, but so many Golf Smarter listeners in the northern part of the U.S., in Europe, in the U.K., have to suffer through this every single year themselves. So, yeah, I think it's a great idea. So Jim and I have scheduled a long recording session later this week to record a bunch of episodes covering a number of topics. But especially, we're going to focus on off-season work, working indoors, short game mechanics, putting, things like that, that I hope will not only keep my sanity as I try to recover, but will give some helpful insights and advice to you. And you should definitely check out his website. He's so good. Anyway, let's go ahead and get back to our golf course architect guest today, David McClay Kidd, with his insights on how amateur golfers can strategize playing a golf hole with a designer's perspective.
Well, it comes as a surprise to many golfers that I don't design golf holes from tee to green. I actually design them from green back to tee. We're always looking for how the green sits into the location that we've selected for the green. And the green might sit in from left to right, or right to left, front back, back to front. There's all sorts of ways that we could nestle it into that natural piece of environment. But when we've decided how it sits in there, we then start coming back down the fairway, deciding, well, where would be the best angle into that green? And once we've figured that out, how do we defend that spot? And then back to the tees. So when the player stands on the tees and views the hole in the mirror effect, they're looking at it in the opposite way than the way we designed it. They have to put themselves in my head. What does the green look like? Where is it best to approach that green? Is it the left side of the fairway, the right side, the short, the long? And generally, if it's a course I've designed, chances are I'll be guarding that spot somewhere in the fairway. So once you've figured all that out, you can then decide what kind of attack you're going to make on that hole and how you're going to make birdie.